Good morning. Welcome to the First Parish Church of Stowe and Acton, a welcoming Unitarian Universalist congregation. My name is Mike Fitzer. I'm the director of music here at FPC. Everyone is invited to coffee hour in Fellowship Hall following our service, and to get there, you follow this hallway. All the way down, you can take the stairs or the elevator down one level to our Fellowship Hall. We also have childcare available at this service, which is the exact same direction but down two levels to our RE space. And if you feel the need at any time during the service, you may bring your child there where they will be well cared for. If this is your first time with us, we're very happy to have you here this morning. Please consider signing our guest book in the vestibule in the front of the church or at coffee hour so that we might know who you are. And as community is so important to us here, we invite you to greet your neighbor. And before you do so, please make sure you put your phone in worship mode so we can be ready to go for the service. Thank you.
Our opening words this morning are a poem titled Winter Solstice by Rebecca Parker. Perhaps, for a moment, the wheels stop rolling, the computers desist from computing, and a hush will fall over the city. For an instant, in the stillness, the chiming of celestial spheres will be heard as Earth hangs poised in the crystalline darkness and then tilts. Let there be a season where holiness is heard and the splendor of living is revealed. Stunned to stillness by beauty, we remember who we are and why we are here. The inexplicable mysteries, we are not alone. In a universe, there moves a wild one whose gestures alter Earth's axis towards love. In the immense darkness, everything spins with joy. The cosmos enfolds us. We are caught in a web of stars, cradled in a swaying embrace, rocked by holy night, babes of the universe. Let this be the time we wake to life. Our chalice lighting words are by Annie Forster. Come we now out of the darkness of our unknowing and the dusk of our dreaming. Come we now from far places. Come we now into the twilight of our awakening and the reflection of our gathering. Come we now all together. We bring unilluminated our dark caves of doubting. We seek unbedazzled the clear light of understanding. May the sparks of our joining kindle our resolve, brighten our spirits, reflect our love, and unshadow our days. Come we now, enter the dawning. And on the fourth Sunday of Advent, we light a candle to symbolize peace, having lit candles for hope, for joy, and for love. These words are from David Breeden. This week, we pledge to work for that most rare of things, peace on earth. In this holiday season, may we find peace inside ourselves. May we be at peace for those around us. And may we renew our commitment to bring peace with justice to our community and the world. May we be peace. Now, I'm told by people from the 9 o'clock service that I picked three unfamiliar hymns all in one Sunday, and so it's a bit of a challenge. I will tell you that they get progressively easier. This is the hardest one. But fortunately, we have a choir and Mike here who I think will help us muddle through. Please stand as you're willing and able and join in 58. Ring out wild bells. Please join in our covenant and affirmation. Love is the spirit of this church, and service its law. This is our great covenant, to dwell together in peace, to seek the truth in love, and to help one another. Our first story, our service is built around three stories today, and the first one is actually titled Raven Steals the Light, and Michelle is going to share it with us.
This is a solstice story. Is this a mic good for the people in the back? Because I don't usually speak up here, so... And it says Raven steals the light, but it actually should be Raven steals back the light. I'm not sure why Raven is made to be the stealer, as he's the rescuer, but you will find out and give your own opinion. In the time before Raven made the stars, and before Tupolak stole the moon and the sun, everyone lived on this side of the sky. Tupolak was a magician with a high cone hat and shoes that allowed him to walk miles in a single step. Raven lived... who was a trickster, lived in his cozy snow hut at the edge of the village. One harsh and cold winter, when the snow froze the very earth, Tupolak put on his high cone hat and his magic shoes. He walked up to the sky and used his power to cut a hole in it. Then he climbed through and built himself a house on the other side. His wife argued with him. "What are you doing?" she cried. "All of our friends are on this side of the sky. If we live on the other side, we will be completely alone." "You can go back and visit them," he assured her. "I don't want to visit. I want to be here right next to everyone and everything. I don't want to live alone." "What do you mean, live alone?" said Tupolak. "You'll be living with me, and we'll have children, and the whole thing will be much more comfortable. Why, everyone will want to visit you." "But no one has your magic, Tupolak. They won't be able to come." "Oh, probably some of them do," he said, and persisted in his plan. He carried from the first world all his magical tools. His wife, sighing with resignation, followed him. After they had settled as best as they could, and had even had a beautiful daughter, Tupolak could see that his wife was still sad and dissatisfied. In order to please her, he decided to steal the light. He climbed back through the hole in the sky and walked in his magic shoes straight to the top of the sky. Then into each of two strong bags, wrapping the necks of the bags tight with rope, he crammed the moon and the sun. He pushed the bags back through the hole and hooked them high on the ceiling of his house, letting out all the light only when he chose to do so. Now, the world on this side of the sky had no light at all. Because Raven loved to sleep, he hardly noticed at first. Whenever he awoke and saw that it was still dark, he snuggled back into his black feathered coat and slept yet again. But the people on this side of the sky were puny and tired with lack of light and food. Finally, the people came to Raven and called weakly at his door. Waking him, they said, "Raven, the sun never comes out anymore, and there's no moon either, and we're running out of food." Raven heard the despair in their voices. "I'll bet Tupolak's behind all this," he muttered. Out loud, he promised the people that he would try to find the sun. "And the moon," they said. "The moon, too," he assured them. "A pretty puzzle," thought Raven. "This is going to be a long journey." So he took as big a bag of food as he could carry, and in another bag, several good-sized rocks. Then, increasingly roused at the idea of outwitting Tupolak, Raven pulled down his beak, drew on his black-winged coat, and soared into the freezing night sky. Whenever he needed to rest, Raven dropped a rock from his pack into the endless dark waters below. The rock changed, kerplash, to an island on which Raven could perch, gobbling down suppers, huddled in his warm feather coat, until he was ready to fly again. Finally, he came to the hole in the sky made by Tupolak's magic. When Raven stepped through, he found himself dazzled by the sunlight on the other side of the hole, for Tupolak had let the sun out of the bag for the day. Raven saw Tupolak in the distance, unmistakable in his high cone hat, soaking up the yellow heat, and Raven coughed. Tupolak squinted. "Is that you, Raven?" he called. "None other," said Raven. "What do you want?" said Tupolak. "The sun and the moon." Tupolak laughed. "Not a chance, Raven. They're mine now." "You are a thief," said Raven calmly. "It does take one to know one," grinned Tupolak, and he stuffed the sun back into his bag. "I'm going to get them back, Tupolak," yelled Raven into the darkness. Tupolak let out the moon and the sun several times, while Raven, munching and dozing, cast about with one idea and then another, trying to form a plan. Then, in the midst of the sunshine, Raven was startled by the appearance of a strong, lovely young woman making her way down to the pool with a water jug in her hand. Could this be Tupolak's wife? No, it must be their daughter. Raven blinked. All at once, he knew what his trick would be. He quickly balled up his black-winged coat, pushed it under a rock, and turned himself into a tiny, tiny feather floating on the still pool of water. Finally, the young woman dipped her jug into the water, and Raven swirled himself inside of it. The woman took a deep drink before beginning her journey home. Jubilantly, Raven Feather slipped down her throat. His plan was working. Now, this is the biggest stretch of the story right here. Sometime later, Tupolak's daughter gave birth to a huge baby boy, whose mother, grandmother, and grandfather were overjoyed. All their pent-up tenderness of those three, alone for so long on the other side of the sky, they poured into this new little boy, who, unbeknownst to them, was Raven in disguise. His mother nursed him and played with him. His grandmother doted on him. Tupolak adored him. Raven, inside his baby form, was very careful to cry and pester for lots of things, so this little family would get used to giving him exactly what he wanted. He bided his time, however, before he asked for the bags of light that hung from the ceiling. One day, his mother noticed a bump on the baby's forehead. "Oh, you've fallen, little one," she crooned, and she nuzzled him and pressed some ice to the bump. But Raven knew then that his beak was beginning to bulge and that he didn't have much more time. Very soon after, he began to cry for the moon bag on the ceiling. "Shh, baby, shh, that's Grandpa's bag," said his mother. But he kept wailing, waving his chubby little hands upward, pouring out rivers of tears. This time his grandmother tried to soothe him, but always his sobbing began again, his mouth gasping for air between the heaves of his chest, his little finger pointing at the bag with moon inside. "Papa's out," said Tupolak's daughter to her mother. "Let's let him have it. What can it hurt? It's tied tightly enough." Tupolak's wife rolled her eyes. It would serve him right anyway if the thing got out. So Raven, hiccuping with joy, was given the moon bag to play with. In seconds, the little boy's face was round and calm as the moon itself. His mother and grandmother rocked back on their heels, enjoying the sweet silence and the happiness of their little baby. However, the minute their attention wandered, Raven unknotted the rope, sure as if he'd had beak and claws, clapping and screeching as the moon sailed out, bouncing through the house's smoke hole. At that point, Tupolak came rushing back to the house when he saw the moon rolling through the tear in the sky. "Who touched my bag?" he bellowed, but stopped short when his wife and daughter pointed to the baby, who ceased his chortling long enough to emit a shriek of joy upon seeing his grandfather. "Dada!" he called and reached for Tupolak's old spotted hand. Tupolak's face softened. The baby cooed and patted his grandfather while Tupolak beamed with pride. The two women looked at each other and shook their heads. Raven wisely waited before he cried again for the sun bag to play with. Then, when Tupolak had settled snoring into a nap, he began his earnest howling, waving his hands as if trying to pull down the sun bag. Tupolak woke up. "Oh, give him anything he wants," he groaned. "Just shut him up." The two women shrugged and pulled down the sun bag. They each wrapped and knotted the rope twice more. Their closure was so effective that Raven this time could not open the bag. Knowing he must act quickly, he rested regretful eyes for a moment on his mama's back and then sped, bag and fist, out the door. I just want you to get that image, little baby, big bag of sun, running. He raced to his rock and donned the black-winged cape he had hidden underneath so long before. Raven took bird form once again. Grasping the sunbag, first in beak, then in claws, he dove through the hole in the sky and streaked away to the people, whose eyes had grown accustomed once again to the light of the moon, but who still lived without the light of the sun. Raven felt hunger pangs as he flew. On he flapped, but his stomach growled for food. By the time Raven spied the people below, fishing in the crooked river by the light of the moon, his wings were trembling with effort. "Gah, gah," croaked Raven weakly. "Give me some fish." "Get your own fish, Raven," said the people. "We hardly have enough for ourselves." "Please," begged Raven. "I'll let out the daylight." "You don't have daylight, Raven," said the people, clearly forgetting that they themselves had asked him to bring the sun. Raven cawed with exasperation. He dropped the sunbag and, with his remaining strength, rammed it three times, pecking in it tiny holes out of which sizzled particles of the sun that tumbled into the sky and began sparkling as spinning stars. "He does have something in his bag," exclaimed the people, and they rushed to ply Raven with fish. Raven gorged, and then, full of power, he tore open the bag. Out exploded the sun, while people cried and covered their eyes. However, in a very short time, they were able to bear again the stupendous light and gratefully prepared Raven an enormous and delectable feast. On the other side of the sky, Tupolak and his family mourned. Some say they got so lonely they came back to this side of the sky. Others say if they came at all, it was to steal the light again. But Tupolak has never been able to take the light for as long as he did that first time. Whenever it disappears and returns again, whenever people watch the moon roll into the sky among the bits of sun that are the stars, they think of Raven. And whenever people hear a baby crying, they remember Raven's trick on Tupolak. So that is one explanation for how the moon and the sun and the stars came to be.
Now, if you think that story was incredible and strange, just wait till you hear the one we tell tomorrow. It also has a god taking the form of a baby and bringing light to the world. Our first poem today is "December Moon" by Mae Sarton. Before going to bed after a fall of snow, I look out on the field, shining there in the moonlight, so calm, untouched, and white. Snow silence fills my head after I leave the window. Hours later, near dawn, when I look down again, the whole landscape has changed. The perfect surface gone, crisscrossed and written on, where the wild creatures ranged while the moon rose and shone. Why did my dog not bark? Why did I hear no sound there on the snow-locked ground in the tumultuous dark? How much can come? How much can go when the December moon is bright? What worlds of play we'll never know, sleeping away the cold white night after a fall of snow. So we have actually passed the moment of the winter solstice, but we begin our service today by going back into the darkness. This is the time of the year when we are in darkness the most, and our reflections to it can be so very varied. Some feel cradled by the darkness, held by it. For some, it is a time of gestation, of dreaming, of slowly awakening. For others, cold and forlorn. In ancient times, it was a great hardship. Plants were buried under snow, and what you had gathered from the harvest had to get you through the cold and dark months. Blizzards created real danger, as did the extreme cold. This is why winter becomes a metaphor for so many hardships of life. It's a metaphor for death, for isolation, for the ending of love. We talk about someone's heart being cold or about being given an icy stare. While it may not have been literally cold here in Massachusetts leading up to this solstice, there is coldness and darkness that comes into our life in many ways. Many of us may have felt a coldness in this country in our response to immigrants that at the southern border. There's a coldness in our midst that makes us covetous, hoarding our resources for the winter famine, afraid to share with our neighbors for fear we won't make it through some hardship to come. So it is no wonder at this moment, this turning point, it became a holiday, a celebration, a time to mark. And it is no wonder that we have so many stories that explain why there are seasons and what people do to make the light and warmth return and why it was taken from us. Indeed, stories of the returning of the sun to the end of winter and the end of winter occur in many cultures. Similar to Raven stealing the sun, Prometheus steals fire, and there are many stories in which the sun or light is stolen from the gods or someone who possesses it. We'll hear a couple more stories about the sun in a bit. Like Persephone returning from the underworld and bringing about spring, there are stories that talk about coming up from an underworld, stories about why spring is born again. It's because this season and these stories were so important and powerful in the cultures around the fledgling Christianity that Christianity purposefully moved its celebration of Christmas to coincide with the older faith's festivals. Saturnalia is the reason for the season. Mithra is the reason for the season. The solstice, Yule, is the reason for the season. And so as the wheel of the year turns, we move from darkness to light. Let's take a moment of prayer and meditation with this poem by E.E. Cummings. I thank you, God, for this amazing day, for the leaping greenly spirits of trees and a blue true dream of sky, and for everything which is natural, which is infinite, which is yes. I, who have died, am alive again today, and this is the sun's birthday. This is the birthday of life and of love and wings and of the gay, great, happening, illimitably earth. How should tasting, touching, hearing, seeing, breathing, any, lifted from the know of all nothing, human merely being, doubt unimaginable you? Now the ears of my ears awake, and now the eyes of my eyes are opened. Blessed be, and amen. And now before our offering, we are going to invite some children to steal a piece of our fire and take it with them. Michelle, would you like to introduce our lantern bearers? Unlike these stories of ancient light hoarders, here in this congregation, we share our gifts with the world. And so in this spirit of giving and of peace, we will now have the morning offering this month split with Potters for Peace.
Thank you.
Special thanks to our guest musicians here and to our choir and music staff, because they're singing like 9 more songs or something tomorrow. It's incredible. Please come, because they are going to reprise many of their Vespers songs. So if you didn't get to see that December Vespers, or if you did, either way, it's going to be another treat. Our next story is The Light Keeper's Box from Venezuela. Both of these first two stories come from a book titled The Return of the Light, 12 Tales from Around the World for the Winter Solstice. At the beginning of the world, by the waters of the Orinoco River, there was no day. The people had only wooden torches to light their villages, and by the flicker of their fires, neither day nor light nor night truly existed. In the midst of one village lived a chief with 2 daughters. News came to the chief of a man somewhere who kept the light. The man called to his oldest daughter and said, "Go and see where this young light keeper is, and come and bring some light to me." And he blew on her face so that the Hebus of the bush, water, and sky might leave her safe. The young woman departed wearing her most lovely Mauritia apron, packed herself a small sack, and left. Just outside the village, she found many roads on which to travel, and she didn't know which one to take. But the one she chose finally led her to the house of the deer. The deer greeted her with his soft eyes and his antlers like fuzzy tree branches above his smooth ears. And she stayed with the deer a long time, laughing, talking, and loving with him. When at last she returned to her father, however, she did not have the light. So the father decided to send his younger daughter, "Go and see where the young light keeper is and bring some light to me." And he blew on her face. And he said, "I will play my flute for you too." And the young woman combed out her hair and set off. And again, she too came to many roads and couldn't decide which one to take. But then she heard the faint sound of her father's flute, and she knew which path to take. Finally, after much walking, she came to the house of the light keeper. The light keeper's face was young, although he seemed very old, and she said, "I have come to meet you, to get some light for my father." "I have been waiting for you," the light keeper answered. "Now that you have arrived, come stay with me." And the young man took up a box made of tightly woven itiriti leaves. If you want to Google that, that's I-T-I-R-I-T-I. Itiriti leaves that he had at his side, and carefully, so that the dreams inside would not spill out, he opened it, and the light colored his sinewy arms brown and his teeth white, and it poured a sheen over her black hair and dark eyes. And so the young woman discovered light, and after showing it to her, the young man closed the lid of the itiriti leaf box. But every day, the light keeper opened the itiriti leaf box so that he and the young woman could enjoy themselves in the light, and they laughed and played sweetly as honey wine. But one day she remembered her pledge to her father to return, and the light keeper held the woman close at first, but then, as a present, gave her the itiriti box filled with dreams and light. "I want you to take this with you," he said. And she took it home to her father and found him there asleep in his hammock. "Father," she whispered, "the Hebus have left me safe, and I have brought you the light." and the chief woke fully and welcomed her, and she showed him the life wrapped in the leaf box, and he hung it from one of the stilts that held up his house, and its dreams drifted out, and the rays of the light touched the crinkled water of the Orinoco, the fan-shaped leaves of the Iti palm, and the yellow-red fruits of the Marae. Word spread to the neighboring villages that the family down the river had some light. People came to see it for themselves. They arrived in their long purple heart bark canoes down this channel and that, boats and more boats, filled with people and more people, and everyone packed themselves in the house of the chief and marveled at the light and the new pictures that came while they slept. And the man and his daughters fried fish after fish for their guests, and the porch filled with more and more people until the slim stilts of the house could no longer hold the weight of so many. Finally, the chief couldn't stand it anymore. "I'm going to end this," he said. "We all want the light, so here it goes." And with a wonderfully strong toss, he hurled the Itariti box and its light into the sky. And the body of the light flew to the east, and the box rolled to the west. Anyway. And the body of the light became the sun. And the box, tightly woven of leaves as it was, turned into the moon. On one side was the sun, and on the other, the moon. And because the chief's throw had been so powerful, they moved very rapidly. The day and night were very short, with sunrise and sunset falling quickly one upon another. But the chief had an idea. "Bring me," he said to his youngest daughter, "a turtle." And the young woman brought a small gray turtle cupped in her hands, and the father blew on the turtle and waited till the sun was just overhead and said, "Son, I'm giving you a present. Take this turtle for your friend. She is yours. I give her to you. Wait for her." And he took up his flute, and the little turtle journeyed up to the sun with the sweet notes of the flute warbling beneath her. And because turtles do not hurry, the sun had to wait a long time for his gift. And when the turtle finally reached him, the sun walked slowly across the sky so that he might keep step with his new companion. And a moon ambled across the sky so as to not interrupt the beginning of this beautiful new friendship. And so to this day, when the sun gets up in the morning, he always travels at a turtle pace. And so the day lasts just long enough until the night comes to the world by the Orinoco River. This reading is The Shortest Day by Susan Cooper. So the shortest day came, and the year died, and everywhere down the centuries of the snow-white world came dancing, people dancing, singing to drive the dark away. They lighted candles in winter trees. They hung their homes with evergreens. They burned beseeching fires all night long to keep the year alive. When the new day's sunshine blazed awake, they shouted, reveling. Through all across the centuries, you can hear them echoing behind us. Listen. All the long echoes sing the same delight, this shortest day and longest night. As promise awakens in the sleeping land, they carol, feast, give thanks, and dearly love their friends and hope for peace. And so do we, here now, this year and every year. And so, at the turning point of the year, we celebrate. We come together in homes or in churches or in caves or in fields, and we light candles, we tell stories, we welcome back the sun. In Iran, the solstice is celebrated as Shab-e-Yalda, which is a celebration of Mithra, the sun god's victory over the dark. An article about the celebration in the LA Times writes, "This celebration, which translates to night of birth, has come to symbolize many things for Iranians," said Turaj Darayeh, a UC Irvine professor of Iranian studies. "This is part of Iranian tradition," he said, "where the evil will run havoc on the longest night of the year. So people gather to be together until evil is gone. It's an old idea where you need protection from evil." During Yalda, people traditionally make wishes and turn to poetry for answers. Each member of the family makes a wish and randomly opens Hafez's book of poems and recites the poem, which is believed to be an interpretation of the wish, Melanian said. "Fruits such as pomegranates are served in thanks for the blessings of the season and prayers for prosperity in the next year," she added. So a holiday of poetry and pomegranates is just my sort of thing. And the warding off of evil with the returning of the sun is a powerful image. Thinking about how to ward off intolerance, ward off hatred, ward off war and famine and violence with the return of the sun is a wonderful way to mark the solstice. I have no pomegranates for you today, but I invite you to think for a moment and find your wish for peace, for justice, for truth, for for the returning of the sun. And here's a poem by Hafiz titled, My Brilliant Image. One day the sun admitted, I am just a shadow. I wish I could show you the infinite incandescence that has cast my brilliant image. I wish I could show you when you are lonely or in darkness, the astonishing light of your own being. And so our wheel turns, the year begins, we ward off the darkness, the cold, the inhumanity, the closed mind, the limiting of the spirit, and we turn our face to the growing sun. Please rise, embody your spirit, and join in hymn number 1063, Winter Solstice Chant. Our third story is Maui and the Sun. And actually, that Winter Solstice book I mentioned has a version of this story also. But I preferred this one because it has pictures. And also, it's written by Gavin Bishop, who is of Maori descent. I'm going to retell it a little bit, though. Maui is a trickster. He played tricks on his brothers all the time. They're not always pleased with that. But one day, he and his brothers were out fishing, and it got dark, and they had to turn in. And Maui said, "It's the sun's fault. He races across the sky as fast as he can so he can get back to bed. The days are so short, we don't have time to do all the things that we want to do." "That's just the way things are," said his oldest brother. "Well, I think we should do something about it," said Maui. "We should catch that lazy old sun and teach him a lesson." "We can't do that," said the brothers. "We're only men. The sun is too hot and fierce." "It could be done," said Maui. "Trust me." And so he turned into a wood pigeon, and he flew up into a nearby tree. And his brothers are like, "All right, we've seen your tricks before, but catching the sun is impossible." And he flew back down and said again, "Trust me." By the next day, he had a plan, and he told the people in the village his plan, and he asked them to go and cut down some flax, and everyone worked for days in the cutting flax until Maui said, "Okay, stop, we have enough. Now let me show you how to make it into ropes," and they made all kinds of ropes, thick ropes, square-shaped ropes, flat ropes, twisted round ropes. And when they'd finished, the ropes were tied into bundles, and they set off towards the sun, but only at night, so the sun wouldn't see them coming. And finally, they came to the pit where the sun hides. And suddenly, from deep down in the earth, there was a giant shudder. The huts where the brothers were hiding trembled and shook, and the air became hot, and the mist at the mouth of the pit disappeared with a hiss, and the earth heaved, and a crack roared along the cray wall where Mrawi hid, and the sun came slowly out, suspecting nothing. Rocks exploded from the heat, and Maui and his brothers watched in awe as the sun rose into the flax rope net which tightened around him. "Hold him now, pull hard," he roared to his brothers, and the ropes jerked tight. And the sun, in rage, screamed and tossed back and forth, and he heaved and strained and tried to bite through the ropes, and some snapped and fell away, but most held fast. Little huts burst into flames, but Maui and his brothers pulled even tighter. And then Maui sprang from his hiding place, and the sun saw him and said, "Why do you treat me like this? Why do you want to hurt the great Tama Nui Te Ra?" And then Maui knew the sun's secret name, and he gained the power to make the sun go more slowly across the sky. Maui gave the signal. The ropes were loosened, and the sun feebly pulled himself from the pit and gingerly rose into the sky, and that day he went very slowly indeed. And Maui and his brothers went home, and they went fishing, and they had all the time they wanted. But Tama Nui Te Ra crept so slowly that he did not return to his resting place for many months. And during this time of constant daylight, the land became dry and parched, and people were tired because it was hard to sleep. And one day, during that time, Maui was out tending his garden, and he held up his hand to block out the sun, and the sun burnt him. And Maui rushed to the sea to cool the pain. And while he was there, the sun decided to quickly set. Maui was furious at being plunged into darkness, and he raced after the sun and dragged him back into the sky. And once more the sun fled west, and Maui again pulled him back. But this time he tied a long rope to the sun and attached it to the moon. And when the sun set the next time, he pulled the moon out of the sea. So from then on, Maui had both night and day. The end. And our last poem is by Timothy Steele, Toward the Winter Solstice. Although the roof is just a story high, it dizzies me a little to look down. I lariat twirl the cord of Christmas lights and cast it to the weeping birch's crown. A dowel into which I've screwed a hook enables me to lift, reach, drape, and twine the cord among the boughs so that the bulbs will accent the tree's elegant design. Friends passing home from work or shopping pause and call up commendations or critiques. I make adjustments. Through a potpourri of Muslims, Christians, Buddhists, Jews, and Sikhs, we are all conscious of the time of year. We all enjoy the colorful displays and keep some festival that mitigates the dwindling warmth and compass of the days. Some say that L.A. doesn't suit the Yule, but UPS vans now, like magi, make their present-laden rounds, while fallen leaves are gaily resurrected in their wake. The desert lifts a full moon from the east and issues a dry Santa Ana breeze, and valets at chic restaurants will soon be tending flocks of cars and SUVs. And as the neighborhood sinks into dusk, the fan palms scattered across all towns stand more calmly prominent, and this place seems a vast oasis in the Holy Land. This house might be a caravansary, the kind of tree a cordial fountainhead of welcome, looped and decked with necklaces and centuries of green, yellow, blue, and red. Some wonder if the Star of Bethlehem occurred when Jupiter and Saturn crossed. It's comforting to look up from this roof and feel that while all changes, nothing's lost. To recollect that in antiquity, the winter solstice fell in Capricorn, and that in the Orion Nebula, from swirling gas, new stars are being born. So the solstice is a holiday that is interwoven into many cultures and many religions because it's so important to our being. Regardless of your theological beliefs, the days had been getting shorter and the nights had been getting longer, regardless of how you celebrate the holidays. Wherever and whoever you are, it is winter here in this hemisphere. And the solstice has occurred, and the days are getting longer. Here at Solstice, we are celebrating cheer to push back that winter and snow. We're saying, celebrating the fact that we know winter will end, and the longest night of the year is past us, and the days grow longer again. The solstice is the birth of the sun. The sun's return, the birth of the sun, whether it is the Oak King or the Prince of Peace, is a time to celebrate, a time to dedicate ourselves to the work of good, of peace, and of justice. It's a time to embrace the possible, to envision the world as it should be, to grow the peace and love and hope and joy with the increasing light. This is a time for celebration, because what a dark night it has been. Welcome back to the sun, whether it is Saturn or Odin or the Oak King or Jesus. Welcome back to the light. We come out of our caves, our darkness, and we light the flaming candles, the Yule logs, the Advent wreaths, and we welcome the sun returning. We welcome peace. We welcome love. We welcome joy. We welcome hope. We long for them to pervade our lives, pervade our culture, our government, our country, pervade the very fabric of our being. Happy solstice. Happy Yule. Merry Christmas. Welcome, light. Let us join together in song. Please rise as you're willing or able. Number 51. Our service here is ended. May we go in peace and joy and hope and love. Merry meet and merry part and merry meet again.